Welcome to the Once Upon a Leader in Africa podcast with George Nudu. We invite you to listen to influencers and opinion shapers narrating their experiences from their leadership roles in Africa, from the world of business, community development, government, corporate, social enterprise, among others. We will glean from their good, bad, and ugly side of their leadership journey and be inspired to overcome adversity, to pursue success against all odds, to be a great leader, and many other lessons. Welcome to the podcast, and here's George Nudu.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you?
I'm well. I am so excited to have you in this podcast. I've been waiting to have a conversation with you about your leadership. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on this podcast.
Thank you for having me, George. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
Okay. Wow. It is. I don't even know. You know, there are so many things on leadership we can talk with you. So I'm just wondering, where do I begin?
From the beginning.
Let's begin from the beginning. So, Catherine, yes. If you are to look back in your life, where can you say you started to lead?
That's a good question. I would actually say that I started to lead in primary school. Why do I say that? It's because I held, you know those class prefects roles that we used to have. So I had one of those prefect roles right from primary school, right into secondary school as well. But I must say that my bigger lessons started from home. I come from a large family, George. We are 10 of us, 6 sisters and 1 and 4 brothers. So a large, large family. My father was a teacher, and he decided to have parliamentary sessions at home. So he gave each of us roles. He gave my brothers, and first my mother was called the Vice President and Minister for Home Affairs. And then I had brothers and sisters who were Minister for Education, Minister for Agriculture, so on and so forth. Now, interestingly, I am the 9th born out of the 10 of us. And so my father said to me, "You're too young for a ministerial post." But within cabinet, they usually have people recording the proceedings, you know. So he made me his minute taker, so to speak. But I watched those parliamentary sessions every evening after prayers around the fire. And I learned so much in terms of leadership from those sessions, from my father, the way he conducted those sessions, the respect he had for his wife, my mother, the respect he had for my brothers and sisters, you know, father respecting children. I learned so much from him in that regard. But most importantly, he, having made me his secretary, went everywhere with me. So, you know, those days in the village, if somebody had no cow and you had more than one milk cow, you loaned them the milk cow. Eventually, when it got its calves, you left them with one calf, so on and so forth. So I would record for him all those things. You know, so and so has our red cow. Are there red cows, brown cow, whatever it is, you know? So I'd make all those records, and I would go everywhere with him as he, you know, checked on his land, checked on his assets, checked on his cows, met with his peers discussing business in the evenings. That's where my leadership journey began.
Wow.
Yes.
My goodness. I'm just thinking, yes. you were already company secretary for your dad.
Thank you. So actually, I am not surprised that I became a lawyer and then a company secretary. I'm not surprised because it was just so natural to me. I keep some of those, he's deceased, but I still keep those minute books up to today. And they were black books, you know, hardcover and all. And yes. I took them all down by hand. I learned those skills from my father.
My goodness, such a great influence.
Yes.
A parent on a child.
So, indeed. I mean,
you know, just what you're saying is, for me, I mm-hmm. have this belief, you know, the mm-hmm. best place to train people is the home.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And not to train when something is going wrong or you're guiding, it's practicing it. So I saw it work. I saw it happen. I heard the conversations and I just knew this is it. And then in the mornings, my father, as I said, was a school teacher, but he was something like a village elder. He didn't have that title, by the way. But our home was always, you know, had people all the time. I can't even remember any one day that we slept in our home alone. We always had cousins, you know, uncles, aunties around. But most importantly, villagers coming home for breakfast in the morning. And I learned discipline from that process because they would come as early as, you know, 6:30, you know, 7 o'clock. And dare my father find you asleep? By the time people are coming for breakfast, you know, crazy. So for me, that discipline in leadership started from there.
Wow, that's amazing. So you've talked about your father and what he did. Tell us, Kathleen, who are you?
Okay, so Kathleen is, first and foremost, I am somebody who's very passionate about integrity, passionate about governance, passionate about how I make people feel. Now, remember, I'm starting with those even before I tell you what I do, because that is so important for me. It's not about titles, it's about who I am and how I have, what impact I have had on you. So that's who I am. Professionally, I'm a lawyer by profession, but one who has veered off more towards corporate governance, which is the one thing I love to do. I worked for, my first employer was UAP, Provincial Insurance, where I worked for 5 years. Then I was headhunted to join Shell when it was still here in Kenya. I worked with Shell for 15 years. During which time, of course, I rose through the ranks and learned so much from my experience at Shell as well. My leadership skills as well were honed at Shell. And in 2013, when Shell divested out of Africa, I also left the company. And that's when I set up my own consultancy firm, which is called Dorion Associates. Dorion Associates focuses on corporate governance consultancies. During that time as well, I became the chair of the Institute of Certified Secretaries of Kenya. And I was then approached by the CMA to assist them draft the Code of Corporate Governance in my capacity as chair of the Institute, Code of Corporate Governance for Listed Companies. So I chaired the team of experts that did that. And soon thereafter, I was then approached by government to lead the process of drafting the Code of Corporate Governance for state-owned entities, you know, state corporations, Mwongozo, as we know it. So I led that process. And, you know, George, there is nothing that gives me the energy and the kick like governance. So for me, it was such, you know, it was such an experience. The timelines were short. And if I give you just a little bit of my story with Mwongozo is that I met Simon Indimuli, who was the officer in charge of governance at the State Corporations Advisory Committee, accidentally one time. And he said, oh, we are looking for an international expert to help us draft the Code of Corporate Governance for state corporations. And I said, Simon, why are you looking for an international expert? Don't you have people in the country who can? He's like, Kathleen, we don't know anybody. I said, try me. And he said, are you serious? That was on a Friday. I said, yeah, I am chair of the institute and I will make sure that we do it. And he said, okay, to prove that you can do it, please make sure that by Monday morning, I have the outline of the code. Now, that's a crazy request because I needed to acquaint myself with what is the problem, what does he want us to do, how does he want it resolved, so on and so forth. But I said, okay, there is actually no harm in giving a broad outline of the code. And this was Friday evening in Nyahururu, drove back to Nairobi, sat down in my house, told my family, please, I'm not talking to anybody, I'm working. So spend at least one night transnighting, which is okay for me. Governance and me, I can actually transnight without a problem. So Monday morning, I gave him the code of corporate governance. The outline. He was amazed at what we had put there. Remember, it's just the outline, nothing much. And then he said, oh, okay, great. This looks good. Let's go meet my boss. We went and met Mrs. Jane Mugambi, who was his boss, and she was happy. And they told us to go ahead. So I put together a team of experts from the institute, and together we drafted that code of corporate governance and handed it over to them. During that time, of course, I was supported by my family in this regard, that they gave me the space to do it. George, perhaps I should mention that I am married to a surgeon, a medical doctor, and together we have three children, Francis, who happens to be my colleague at work now. Yes, he finished his BCom, and I said, come and work with us, you know, so he's here with us. And then Tony, who is about to complete his degree at Riara. And then last, we have Laura, who is in Form 3 at Kianda. So the support they gave me is Daddy actually stepped into Mommy's shoes as well. You know, looking after the kids, dropping them in school, homework. I have been lucky that he is the one who's been doing a lot of those things, which gives me the chance to really focus on what I love to do as well.
He's a real man.
He is oh, a real amazing. Man. Yes.
Yeah. Supporting
yes,
you.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much. You've talked about governance. And most of the time I bring people here, they talk about leadership. I've had a few people who have, like Martin O'Dwork, came and you talked a bit about governance. Let's talk to me about governance. Why is your passion there and how is it different from leadership?
So leadership is actually part of governance. Or should I say governance? One is part of the other. Why do I say that? Governance is basically the way we do things around here, whatever your here is. If you think about my father, for example, those meetings that we used to have at home, and I must tell you this one, my father had rules at home. And one of the rules I remember was that at 9 o'clock, you don't come to my house. You know, 9 p.m., you don't come to my house. If you're late, stay where you are. And I remember my brothers, two of them one time, I don't know who gave them alcohol. You know, they were young men and I think somebody gave them alcohol and they came home singing round about midnight. Wow, my father, he did not do anything to them. He let them into the house. They slept. The next day, remember I said we woke up very early because of visitors in the home. So we woke up very early and my brothers were summoned. They were told, okay, here is a rope each. Go into that boma and each of you must bring me either a cow or a bull, whichever pleases you. Just go and bring one. So I grew up in the village. So my brothers go into the boma. They are puzzled, but they go and they do as they are told. They each drag a cow or bull to where my father is. And then he says, okay. You see this lady over here? This is my wife. And you do not come into my house late in the night expecting my wife to give you food. So, dear sons, the reason you have a cow each is so that you can go and bring me that girl who has been keeping you out there so that she can officially give you food when you come late. I have never laughed like that because the ropes just dropped from the from the hands of my brothers, you know. So his way of doing things was rules, regulations, was respect for each other, respect for the rules, respect for everybody. So the way we do things around there, that was our governance in the home. That was our family governance. Now, for institutions, it's exactly the same. What rules do you have in place? What values guide you as an organization? How do you relate with each other? What are the, you know, like the structures, you know, the governance structures, the structures with how you lead that organization? So that's basically governance. And that's why I say leadership is part and parcel of governance. And you cannot have a governance structure that can stand the test of time unless you have a leader who focuses you on those values, on those structures, on those rules and regulations that you want to follow.
I always get this idea, Catherine, that governance also begins really at the board level.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And that's why we talk about tone at the top, yes. George.
Yeah.
And the reason why it begins at the board level is that leadership that you talked about. Somebody must lead it. Somebody must drive it. If you take shareholders, for example, these are people who have pulled together their funds and who then are entrusting those funds to the board to say, guys, go away and make money. You know, the parable of the talents. Go away, make money, bring it back to me. They are not involved in day-to-day operations, but they expect a return. So they expect leadership from the board. They then give the board other resources, you know, those funds, you can employ people who will do the day-to-day for you, but lead and give me the return that I'm asking for. And that return is not necessarily money. It may be other things. If it was money, we wouldn't have NGOs. If it was money, we would not have the, you know, the not-for-profits, you know, whatever it is, the value that you're looking for from society. So the board must drive the culture they want. The board must formulate the values they want. They must set the rules they want. And most importantly, they must live by those rules that they set themselves so that they give an example to the rest of the employees. And the rest of the employees are basically looking up to the board, you know, for guidance. Let me give you another analogy, George. I used to read books about the war in those, you know, those olden English medieval days. And there was always the concept of the watchtower. And there would be people sitting up at the watchtower giving directions to the foot soldiers. You know, we can see across the hills, these guys are coming on horseback. You need to do 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, the guys in the watchtower stayed there. They did not come down to fight. So that's the board. The board sits up there giving direction to the foot soldiers to do 1, 2, 3, 4. So the leadership comes from there, but the actual doing is the foot soldiers, the management, the staff, so on and so forth.
I believe your experience of corporate governance in training and consulting and working with boards and even being in boards, what have you been seeing, you know, just from your experience in corporate governance and working with some of your clients, what are some of the challenges that boards have?
The first challenge, George, that I would like to mention is that separation of the role between the board and management. Naturally, as human beings, we just want to do. But here is corporate governance telling you, hey, as a board member, you know, focus on strategy, focus on policy, let others do what you want done. So the challenge for board, many board members, particularly if things are not working the way they ought to be, is the tendency to want to step in to do things. And that causes a friction between the board and management, because ideally, the board should just, you know, give guidance, be available to support, but wait for management to come back to them. And of course, give direction on strategy, on policy, so on and so forth. So when you step into the shoes of management, that is bound to cause a problem, because governance is very clear on that. It says hands out. It actually says eyes in, ears in, but hands out. So just see, just hear, but don't do. When you think about it, holding your hands at the back can be quite difficult all the time. So that's the first challenge I see. The second challenge that I'm seeing with many boards is the lack of a very direct agenda to be forward looking. So you're looking at just, you know, solving the problems that are here now, but you're failing to look at the future so that you're better prepared for it. I want to give an example of one of my clients, and I'm not afraid of mentioning the name, Centum, some time back. And I went to do a board evaluation. So I asked them, what are you doing? That was the time that they were just about to move into Two Rivers. Two Rivers had just been completed, but they had not commissioned it, so to speak. And I asked, so how is Two Rivers coming along, so on and so forth? They said, oh, you can ask management that question. We moved on, you know, after we conceptualized the idea, we moved on. So that is now for management to work on. That ability for the board to be forward-looking 3 to 5 years ahead can be quite a challenge, because the tendency is to focus on the here and now. And in governance, we say spend about 40% on the here and now, but 60% on the future. So that is the second challenge. The third challenge that I see for most boards is you let culture just happen. You don't drive the culture you want to see. So when you look at the agenda for the board, you hardly see discussions on culture. And I think for me, that's a big one, because as you know, Peter Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I keep saying for lunch and dinner as well, you know. So if you don't have discussions on culture, if I look at your work plan for the year and I don't see any discussion on culture, I've got to ask, what sort of culture are you driving if you're not being deliberate about it? You're not discussing it. You're not saying what is right or wrong. So that is the third big one that I see. The fourth big challenge that I see with most boards is it's becoming better now, but previously you would find a board that looks like one person, behaves like one person. So there's no diversity. That's what I'm trying to say. That is changing, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 3 years or so. That is now changing. So we are now talking about have a diversity matrix that speaks to your stakeholders, that speaks to your strategy. So those would be the main challenges that perhaps I would say I am seeing.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. Those are good ones. And now that you've talked about diversity, you know, now it's moving to that other passion for you. You know?
Yes.
Yeah, Women's On Board Network,
yes,
amazing,
yes.
Job. Congrats.
Thank you.
You are doing good. So, and that is, it's very interesting to see the way you keep celebrating the women getting on boards, even on LinkedIn. So it's always,
thank
that's
you.
Very exciting. Tell me the story, how you, I know you're one, wow, of the founding members. Just,
yes,
briefly, where did that spark and how has it, the journey been for you?
The journey of Women On Boards Network goes back to when I was doing the codes, when I was drafting the codes. So starting from the CMA code onto Mwongozo, you know, in those two codes, we put in that every board must have a diversity and skills matrix. But at that point in time, that was around 2015, the boards were not as diverse as they are now. We are not where we ought to be, but at least we are better off, you know. And so those were the days when women sitting on boards were probably less than 10% of the total board members. So I would ask chairs of boards, so why don't we have women on boards? And they would say, where do we find them? You know, that was one answer. The second answer was, even the one we have on our board does not even speak Catherine. Why do you want us to have another one? So I'm like, what are you talking about? And you know, George, I got those responses so many times that I decided, you know, Catherine, if you don't want a certain culture, you must do something about it. So I said, okay, I'll do something about it. I wasn't sure how it will pan out, but all I knew is I needed a database where those board members or those chairs who are saying they didn't know where to find them, they could access. And two, to respond to the ones who are saying they don't speak, I would build the capacity of the women. So I called three of my friends who are also lawyers, Ankirote Moria, a lawyer, a great governance expert, Rose Lumumba, a lawyer, a great governance expert, and listen to this, Calvin Nyachoti, a gentleman, a lawyer, and a great governance expert as well. So I called them and I said, guys, we have to do something about this. And they agreed with me. So we contributed some funds, we put it together, and we set up this company called Women on Boards Network. And we said, okay, let's sort out the problem that we identified. So that is how Women on Boards Network began. We launched it in 2014. It has grown in leaps and bounds. The diversity on boards here in Kenya has really, really improved. We are now at 36% women to men. We are not where we ought to be, but we are better than most of the countries, not just Africa. We are not talking about Africa, but across the world. UK is actually behind us in terms of diversity. It is amazing when you just try to develop the capacity of the women, pull them together, help them network in the best way they know, and just help them to be their best, the best they can be. The latest one that we have added on to the Women on Boards Network began with my daughter following me around the annual conferences. We would have this annual conference and my daughter follows me. And because there were no other children her age, she would just, you know, hang around the secretariat being sent for water, being sent for what. Then I said, hey, come on, I can start developing the leadership skills of this girl at this age. So we decided to put in place a junior wing of, now we decided we don't want to limit it to the girls. So we said, why develop girls only? You will have such a strong group of women, but the boys are being left behind. So we said for the junior wing, we would open it up to both the boys and the girls. So from around about the age of 12, up to the point when they get their first job, they can become junior members of the Women on Boards Network. What do we do for them? We focus on their skills. We focus on mentorship. So it's an amazing group of young girls and boys who are developing their skills. They're attached to mentors. We are now talking about linking them up with their Mauritian counterparts, just so that they know, they grow up knowing that it is possible. They can lead, nothing should stop them. So that is how the Women on Boards Network started and how it has evolved over time. It has a board of directors, so chaired by myself. My co-founders are members of the board, but we did expand the board and brought in three additional members. And one of those additional members is also a gentleman. So we have two men on the board, Alvin and Reverend. And then we have the rest of us are ladies. But we did say that we preach diversity on boards. And if we preach diversity on boards, we too have to be diverse. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. You know, my wife Bev is in that network. And There's this coterie that they have bonded so much. It's amazing. They came to my house the other day. It was so lovely just to see them, and they are doing their own things. It is so good. It is really good.
And you know, Bev has been such a pillar right from the beginning. I think the second annual conference we had, she was actually one of our presenters. So really, really depending on her for a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. And she loves being part of the network. She really loves.
Thank you.
So that's really good.
Thank you.
That's good. And
you know,
if she's happy and I'm happy,
then you're happy.
Very true.
So, it's really,
thank you so much, Kathleen, just for the things that you are doing and the passion that you have, and just being a leader in your own way. You said some things make you tick. You said governance make you tick. I guess even empowering women and putting them into the boards. So what keeps you motivated? Because you sound so motivated. What keeps you motivated in the things that give you a kick?
So for me, it is about that change that I'm enabling. And by the way, I am a lawyer by profession, but law does not give me that energy that governance and women give me. So when you see the change, when you see that you have opened a door for somebody, like somebody is looking for a board member, and there is one of your network members who gets that position, that gives me the kick. When you see you do a consultancy for a board and you see the change and they bring you back, you keep being their governance auditor, you keep being their board evaluator, you can see them grow from year to year, that gives me the kick. I think for me, I just love being there for people, is something that I love. My family knows that every Saturday when I go shopping, I will always have two other bags that I shop for, not people I know. I stop on the road, I just look and I see, does this person look like they're needy? And I call them and I say, can I offer you this? You know, sometimes some of them will run away from me because they might think I want to kidnap them or something like that. But it is just that smile that you see. And you know, you hear stories like, Mungu akubariki, sikukuwa na chakula leo, you know, and you're like, my God. And yet for you, you take it for granted. So just enabling a change in society, enabling a change in people, really is what drives me.
If you are to use a symbol or a metaphor or something to describe yourself, what would that be?
What comes to mind is a pineapple. And the reason a pineapple comes to mind, by the way, I have no clue what it means in other quarters, but why a pineapple comes to mind is because the pineapple, the flesh of the pineapple itself, is inside, and it is supposed to be sweet. And there are all these things which are attached to it. You have the head, which has so many, is it called the head? What is it called? That thing you break off, that one. It has so many things attached to it. It is not one thing, it is many things.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the body of the pineapple itself, it is also made up of so many other things. Mm-hmm. I would describe my life as that, because I don't live in a cocoon. I live with people. I have people attached to me, and I want to believe that other people see me in a similar fashion.
That is so amazing. Thank you for
sharing that.
Thank you. As we end, I like to ask two questions. So one question is, when you think of legacy, what legacy do you want to have?
Do you know, George, that's another question that drives me, honestly. Because I have to keep asking, when I die, what are people going to say about me? What are they going to say? So for me, I am confident that the one legacy I will leave in this country is the legacy of good corporate governance. I have poured myself out in the area of corporate governance to many boards, to many leaders, and I've shared my journey in that regard. But I would also like to leave a legacy where people value each other, you know, just moving the envelope in terms of personal, individual values, then morph that into organizational values. So I'd like to leave a legacy where people are valued, people respect each other, people know that they cannot exist on their own. They reach out to other people, and that's a challenge we currently have. I'm sure, George, you go to the village, visit your relatives, visit your aunties, uncles. The current generation is not like that. And so I keep talking to my nieces and nephews and children about that connection to your roots, connection to the people who have made you who you are. Interestingly, and I need to tell you this one, I said we are 10 in our family. Now, God has blessed us and we are all alive. Each of us is married, and we have this organization called Ebenezer, the biblical Ebenezer, of course. And Ebenezer is made up of my father's children and their spouses. And we have been meeting for the longest time ever. Next year, we celebrate 20 years. And guess what? We meet monthly, every month. In fact, COVID was such a drain on us because we couldn't meet, and we meet. So if I'm the one hosting, they will come to my house with their spouses. They will, you know, sleep. Most of the time we insist on sleeping, and we have our general meeting, whatever we call it. But really, it's just about connecting with each other. 3 weeks ago, we spent 4 days in Diani. My father has 10 children and their spouses. Now, we have passed on that value to our children.
Yes.
And they have formed what is called the Ebenezer Juniors. So we try to encourage them to meet as well. They're not meeting as frequently as we are. They meet twice a year. But we want them to meet more often because we are telling them, your family is so important to you. They have now split themselves into two, the married Ebenezers, because some of them are married now, and the unmarried Ebenezers, because they have different needs as well. So we have one of us who looks after the married Ebenezers. They meet with her. They talk about how to support each other. It's almost like counseling, whatever it is you may call it. And then we have another one, my brother, who is the patron of the overall Ebenezer Juniors. And those are the values we want to instill in them. Everybody is important. Connectivity is important.
Oh my goodness. I am both challenged and mesmerized. Wow.
You should have seen us before Corona. Yes. My father is deceased, but my mother isn't.
Yes.
My mother is alive. So before Corona, we dragged her along to Mombasa with us.
So
she had these children, had 10 children and their spouses around her for about 3 days. She was so happy.
That's a blessing. That is a blessing.
Yes.
That is amazing. That is very, very unique. And definitely,
thank
as
you.
You're talking, keeping that tradition and that connectivity. Yes. That's a great legacy. So
you've
given us your story. You've talked great things. And this other question I like to ask my guests. So what is the moral of your leadership story?
I would say that the moral of my leadership is centered around integrity.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the values, and Dorian Associates, my small consultancy, actually has values as well.
Mm.
And the first of those values is integrity. The moral is of my story is of my leadership is if only we reached out to each other with integrity, with respect, there is enough for everybody. And we can carry each other along and we would live happily ever after.
There you go. If it was in church, I'd have shouted a big amen.
Thank you, George.
That's the truth. That is the truth.
Thank you. So thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. It has been joy. It has been fun having you in our podcast. And I know those who are listening have felt your joy, your influence, and your positivity. Thank you so much, Catherine. It has been a great honor. And I wish you all the best and success as you continue leading.
Thank you so much, George. And thank you for what you're doing, because these stories do inspire others. So really, really grateful for having me on the podcast. Asante.
Thank you for joining us in today's podcast. We hope you're leaving with insights that will help you live and lead better. We appreciate our sponsors, BNG Consultants Limited and BNG Center for Leadership Coaching, for keeping us on air. Bye for now. See you in our next episode.